This is Amy Hall. With me is Greg Kokel, and you're listening to Stand to Reason's hashtag STR Ask podcast. And we welcome you. Thank you for listening.
Good morning, Amy.
Good morning, Greg. Let's start with a question from Bird. C.S.
Bird?
Lewis.
Like the flying?
Yes.
Okay.
C.S. Lewis in Mere Christianity argues free will makes evil possible, the only thing that makes love, goodness, and joy worth having. If there won't be evil in heaven, how can we have free will to choose and thus make his love worth having?
Well, there's a very simple and straightforward response to this that I've given many times. I'm not sure that we both agree on this, so I'd be interested to hear your input. But I think the free will defense in that way, in other words, free will is the only thing that makes love possible, is not a good defense. And for the reason that the questioner is raising, if God does not have the freedom to sin, and that's the question here, freedom to sin. Now, we're not talking about the broader issue of determinism. We are just simply asking about whether one has the freedom to sin. And the argument that is offered is that unless you have the freedom to sin, then love is not meaningful. Then you're just a chatty Cathy, so to speak. This is an old toy people used to use, a doll that you pull a string and it says, I love you, I love you. And it's just mechanical. And of course, the problem there is obvious. Not only will we not be able to love in heaven because, at least arguably, we will not have the freedom to sin because we will be morally perfect, God never loves because he does not have the freedom to sin. His moral perfections disallow that so-called freedom. It's actually not a real freedom. It's not like a lack of ability. It is a capability. It is the ability to live morally perfect in virtue of his character. So I think this is not a good argument. I think that there is a free will argument that can be offered, but not that one. And I've never, well, actually in the past, many years ago, I did advance that one until I thought about it. And incidentally, and this is something that I've never actually heard anybody else say, but I've mentioned a number of times since it's dawned on me, we don't love as acts of freedom anyway. Okay? Think about it. I ask people when we discuss this, do you love your children? Of course I do. And when did you start loving them? Right when they were born. Oh, really? Did you say, oh, that one's my kid, I am choosing to love them as an act of my free will? No, love happens in you, all right? And when people get married, love happens to them too, which is why, at least in the West, we choose to marry who we do, because love is happening. That's why people use the phrase fall in love. Okay, it's something that happens to them. It is not something they're choosing to do. Now, there is a sense that's entirely legitimate in which you choose to be loving in certain relationships when you don't feel love, marriage, children, etc. But that really isn't the heart and core of love. And many will say, well, that's a different kind of thing going on where you're choosing to act loving as opposed to feeling the love. The feeling of the love is not something you choose. It is something that happens in virtually every single case, and it is our universal experience. Being able to love in a deep and rich way is not related to freedom of choice at all, and it never has been. By the way, this opens up then some possibilities with regards to the way God works sovereignly in the distribution of grace and the whole issue of God's sovereign grace and its relationship to our choice, okay, of him. I think it's entirely legitimate to argue that God works on us in such a way that he creates love in us for himself and a desire for himself, just like our exposure to some person in our life generates in us a love and desire for them that we then act on by getting married to that person, or if it's just a friend hanging out with more often. Okay, if love happens by some external thing, then that external thing could easily be God working with regards to our relationship with him. And it's interesting that Jesus uses language similar to this in John 6 when he says, no one can come to me except that the Father draws him. And then the picture there is a fish net in which someone is captured and drawn in. And so it's a picture of sovereign grace, God doing the acting. But the way he acts in our lives is such that we then desire him. It's not a violation of our freedom any more than falling in love is a violation of our freedom. And what's interesting, too, about this notion of falling in love, just to add a sharper point to it, when people get involved in illicit relationships, sometimes their weak defense, I think, morally weak defense, is, I didn't choose this. I didn't plan to do this. It happened. You know, the famous Judy Garland song, You Made Me Love You, I Didn't Want to Do It. Well, it's capturing something true about the condition. Now, of course, it's not a legitimate reason to pursue that. But notice that even people involved in illicit relationships are acknowledging that sometimes they aren't choosing the emotion. These things happen to them. Unfortunately, immorally, they give in to those things. But notice the genesis. The genesis is outside, not inside. And so these are the reasons why I don't think this way of arguing regarding the fall is a good way to argue. And I'm not sure how much Lewis develops this idea, but the core of it is that if we don't have the freedom to choose to love, then love is not legitimate. And that, I think, is a false statement. So insofar as that concept is informing, to some degree, a person's explanation of why there's evil in the world, I don't think it's a good one. I do not develop that argument in The Story of Reality. I develop a little different kind of argument. But it's not the argument that free will is what makes love possible. Because, and free will in this regard, being freedom to do otherwise, libertarian free will, freedom not to love, okay? Because otherwise there would be no love in heaven and there would be no love in God's character.
I think this is the exact right question to ask, because if you are using as the defense for God in for the existence of evil, if you're saying that the purpose of... Well, let me back up. I'm losing my train of thought here. If you are using the idea of free will to explain evil, because otherwise there would not be real love, I think this person is exactly right. There's no way to explain how things mm-hmm. are happening in heaven. It doesn't make sense. And I think that
how there could be a love in heaven.
Right. I would say, Greg, you pointed out that the idea of libertarian free will is what he's talking about here. There are different ways to understand what meaningful choices or how meaningful choices are possible. And this question kind of assumes that libertarian free will is the only way that's possible. And I disagree with that. And I know you do when it comes to salvation.
Can you explain the concept for our listeners, Amy?
So
libertarian free will is?
So libertarian free will is the idea that all... that you can choose to do otherwise, I think, is probably the basic way of saying it. I'm not a philosopher, right. So I might not be getting this exactly technically.
No, that's right.
Accurate,
that's,
but yeah,
that's the CDO. That's the pardon me for walking on you there. That's the CDO condition of libertarian. Could have done otherwise. So if we have libertarian free will, we can love or we cannot love. If God has libertarian free will, then God can choose to love or not to love. That certainly is in his capability. So,
and in this case, too.
That's the definition, libertarian.
Uh-huh. If the idea is that evil is possible with free will, then as you pointed out, Greg, this would say the same would be true for God. But we know that Our choices come out of our nature. And this is why God's choices are always, always perfectly good. And yet he still has free will. It's because it's coming out of our nature, and our love comes out of our nature. So when God corrects our nature at the end of time, he's correcting our fallenness, and that means we will love correctly, which means we will love God correctly. And so that will come out of our nature. We won't sin because our nature will be corrected and we won't be fallen anymore. But again, I think this defeats the idea that the possibility of doing evil is necessary for true love to happen. So this brings us, Greg, to the next question from Rolf Anderson. I've heard that we will continue to have free will after we die, yet we will not sin because all our desires will be met in heaven. If so, couldn't God have created this universe to be such a place so that no one would desire to sin and thus none would be lost to hell?
Yeah, that's a fair question. And the answer is, of course, he could have done that if he desired. I do explore this idea a little bit in the story of reality, and the answer is going to be somewhat speculative because we don't have a direct answer to why God made a world that could go bad when he could have made one that couldn't. All right? And he could have made a world in which there were no moral creatures at all. It could all be animals. All right? And what I argue in the story of reality is that though he could have made that kind of world, that would contain no creatures that he could be in meaningful relationship with. We have the most meaningful relationships with other creatures who are like us, share some similarity or some qualities. Being made in the image of God, in a certain sense, qualifies human beings for the unique friendship that God wanted to have with us. And I think that what God desired was a friendship in which he could share his happiness. God is perfectly happy because he is perfectly fulfilling his nature and all of the aspects of his nature. And he wants to be in a kind of friendship with others that he could share his happiness with. Now we come at a crossroads, though, if that seems to make sense, then what is the best way to make the best kind of creatures that can do that? It turns out that there are virtues that cannot be had or expressed or developed in an unfallen world. Okay, so if we have a virtue, if it's a virtue to be long-suffering, that is, to persevere in the midst of unjust suffering, and I think that is a virtue, biblical virtue, well, that can't happen unless there's suffering. And suffering can only happen in a fallen world, that kind of fall. And so this is a theodicy. In other words, this is an argument that is meant to explain why God allowed evil in the first place. And there are different approaches to this, but this is one of them. And that is, it's a soul-making theodicy that God can form our souls in particular ways that are that could not be formed in the absence of a fallen world. Okay, now of course people could say, well, why didn't God just form our souls that way and give us the quality of long suffering, even though there was no opportunity to express it or exercise it? And see, this is where we start getting into issues of the mind of God that we just don't know about. Okay, he hasn't told us why. He has told us that the world he made was good and that the world that will come, the restored world, will be better. I mean, this seems to be the case. And so God is taking something that's bad and he's making something good out of it and better than if the bad hadn't been there to begin with. So this is where, for me, and I'm trying to remember all that I wrote in the Story of Reality because I went into more detail. I may not be able to remember all of the details, but some of them are I've just mentioned. And people can go back to that section under man about the fall to see my reasoning there. And I think there's that helps us to make more sense out of why God created this particular kind of world, a world that could go bad and then could be fixed. Even though I don't have like an absolutely thoroughgoing theodicy that seems to cover all of the bases, but I know you had, in some aspects of the way I treated this problem in The Story of Reality, you being my superb editor of that book, one of two magnificent content editors. Nancy Ulrich was the other one. You had some concerns about that, so in a little difference of opinion. So I'm not sure if it applies to this question, but what do you have to say about that, Amy?
Well, there are a couple aspects to this question. I want to address the first part first, when he says, we will not sin because all our desires will be met in heaven. The problem with our desires is not that they're not met. The problem with our desires is that they're the wrong desires. So I don't think the idea that our desires will be met in heaven is the answer to why we won't sin in heaven. I think our desires will be changed so that our nature will no longer be fallen and that we'll only desire to do good things. So I think we'll good actually point. Be changed in that way. But as for why, you know, couldn't God have created a world where no one would be lost to hell? Yes, I agree that God could have done that. And I think, Greg, I take a little bit different, a little bit different explanation of that. And what I think the answer to that is, if you look at what God's purpose was in creation, as far as we can tell just from his revelation, I think the ultimate purpose of creation was for God to reveal himself to us. He wanted us to know him. He wanted us to know him in an intimate way. He wanted us to know him in a way that is more than just us reading certain aspects about him. The way you get to know someone, if I gave you a list of somebody's characteristics, you wouldn't know them in the same way as if you had experienced those characteristics in some sort of a story or in an interaction or some way like that. That's just the way we get to know people. And so when we look at what God's highest revelation of himself is, it over and over, it talks about to the praise of the glory of his grace. His grace is the highest revelation of his love and of his goodness and his greatness. And so because of that, how does one experience grace? You can only experience grace in a fallen world. You can only experience dependence on God. You can only experience a true understanding of your creatureliness and your frailty in comparison with God. You can only understand his forgiveness if you've sinned. All these things you can see. You see God's justice, so you see God's wrath against sin, so you see his righteousness in that way. There are a lot of aspects of God that we never would have seen in a world that never fell. So that is my theory. I mean, obviously the Bible doesn't come out and say, this is why God created a world where people would fall. But I think just putting together all the aspects of why God created in the first place, and then the question of how does he accomplish that, I think that is a good direction to figuring out why God created a world where people could fall.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree with that. I think what this shows is this is a multifaceted question, and there are different elements that are involved with it. And this is a really good one. The fact that God is revealing himself and his glorious self in all aspects, and these become evident in the circumstances we face in a fallen world, which includes grace and forgiveness. I had somebody ask me in a Q&A at a Summit Ministries a couple weeks ago in South Carolina, what's my favorite attribute of God? And I'd never been asked that question before. I had to think for a moment. But one word came to my mind, and so I responded initially by contrast, and it's not justice. It's rather grace. It's grace. That is the thing that appeals to me emotionally. I mean, it isn't like one attribute is greater than the other. They're all equal expressions of God's perfections. But since it was asked, what was my favorite? Well, that's a subjective question. And my favorite is grace for the reasons that you've just described.
Well,
it
the
is
Bible,
what we have become profound recipients of.
The Bible talks about how mercy triumphs over judgment. So even in that sense, God's grace reveals his love and his justice, because it wouldn't be grace if there weren't justice. So that just reveals a level above that. And I know we've talked about this passage in terms of this issue before, Greg, but I also wanted to point out that it isn't just our experience of grace that teaches us about grace in a fallen world, but Romans 9 actually says that our seeing God's judgment also increases our understanding of his grace, because we're seeing what we deserved and we're seeing that we don't have that. And this is in Romans 9, where it says, what if God, although willing to demonstrate his wrath and to make his power known, endured with much patience vessels of wrath prepared for destruction, and he did so to make known the riches of his glory upon vessels of mercy, which he prepared beforehand for glory. So there are a lot of different ways that seeing his judgment and his righteousness and his justice also instructs us as to his grace and his love. It's a very complicated issue, and since God doesn't just, you know, because people will often say, well, why couldn't God just download this information into our minds? But that's not how we work as human beings. We learn by stories, we learn by experiencing, not by just reading, God is good, God is just. I mean, that's not the same quality as seeing God's goodness and justice.
It's abstract, and it reminds me of Jesus' comment, he who is forgiven much loves much. Okay, not he who realizes that I am the perfectly forgiving God loves much, but rather the one who is forgiven much loves much. So that goes right to your point. And it does show, I think, that a lot of these issues can, we can come to a reasonable resolution about them by thinking about God's nature and the attributes of God. And when we reflect on those and see what does the scripture reveal about the attributes of God, and what are the necessities of a perfect being, the moral perfections there, then these help inform these kinds of questions that we have.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Greg, and thank you, Bird and Rolf Anderson, for your questions. And we look forward to hearing from you. Please send your questions on Twitter with the hashtag STRask, or you can go through our website. Just go to our contact page, and when you get to the drop-down menu, choose I have another question and put hashtag STRask somewhere in your question. And that goes straight into a folder for this podcast. We've been getting more and more of these, Greg, and I really appreciate people sending in their questions that way, because I realize a lot of you don't have Twitter. We want to make this available to everybody. So send in your question. We'd love to hear from you. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.